Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Tom Waller. I'm chair of the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled Microfinance, Promise or Peril. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events which are held here at the club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker. And I wanted to just highlight that in the Business and Leadership Forum, we try to cast a wide net when we have speakers come in. It's not all about business suits kinds of topics. I like to think of it as it's about the business of leading our lives. And a favorite guru of mine in the field of leadership is Margaret Wheatley, who has defined leadership, or a leader, as anyone willing to help. And I think it's kind of a disarming and perhaps overly simple definition of leadership. But I think our speaker tonight, and his colleagues as well, that he works with at the organization that will be highlighted this evening, exemplify that in terms of their pro bono contributions to a very valuable type of program that's helping to address abject world poverty. So I just wanted to add that little introductory note because I meant it. So since January 2007, Sanjay Sinha has been the Deputy Chief Financial Officer of Microcredit Enterprises, MCE, a nonprofit tax-exempt organization that operates in a space commonly known as microfinance. MCE is committed to helping alleviate poverty in the developing world. As with 80% of MCE's management team, Sanjay serves in this position on a pro bono basis. Sanjay was introduced to the world of microlending at an early age while living in India. Microbusinesses such as gardening services, laundry, and small retail outlets were all around his community at that time. However, he did not know back then that some of these businesses were made possible by the microfinance movement that was founded in the neighboring country of Bangladesh by the Nobel laureate Muhammad Yunus. Professionally, Sanjay has spent most of his career in the financial services industry, primarily as a relationship manager. His focus has been on developing and managing relationships with Fortune 500 and middle market companies in a variety of industries. He is currently with California Bank and Trust Corporate Lending Group here in San Francisco. His previous banking experience includes 2 years with Rabobank International and 7 years with Yasuda Trust and Banking Company. In addition to his tenure and experience in banking, Sanjay spent 3 years with the Coca-Cola Company in Atlanta, Georgia, and 2 years with two internet startups in Silicon Valley, first with BigVine.com and then with CompanyFinance.com. Sanjay holds a Bachelor of Science degree in management from the University of Tennessee and an MBA in finance from Georgia State University. Since 2007, and here's just another indication of Sanjay's making a difference in giving back mode of living, he has also been a pro bono business advisor with Pacific Community Ventures, a private equity and business advisory group that focuses on providing capital and strategic advice to businesses in low and middle income neighborhoods in the state of California. Will you please join me in welcoming Sanjay Sinha?
Thanks, Tom. Thank you for being here. I'm really happy to be at the Commonwealth Club. And this evening, I'll talk about a topic that's been in the news a lot, you know, subprime mortgage. But I'll talk about it in the context of industry life cycle. So we'll take it through the four stages of the industry life cycle. And then I will talk about microfinance in the same light, four different stages. And then we'll talk about what the similarities are, because there's been some talk about how microfinance is an asset class and it has some of the peculiarities of subprime mortgage industry. We'll talk about the differences. We'll talk about some of the challenges that the industry is facing, and then I'll just conclude with some remarks. This is the industry life cycle. I think you've seen this before. Basically, four stages. You've got introduction, growth, maturity, and decline. I have just put, you know, one item from each stage, not to imply it's the only one that should be paid attention to, but, you know, just to sort of look at it as the subprime mortgage industry has developed. So new product, again, it's something that's introduced, there's innovation, or there's something that comes about as a result of an existing product, right? In this case, the mortgage industry was already there. and the new product was subprime mortgage. Supply chain is simply where the vendors, in my mind, have some power, right? And if you think of vendors in the mortgage industry, think of entities that are providing capital, okay? Enormous power. The third phase, you've got less competition. Again, a lot of companies go out of business. And the last one, either the industry dies or there's a replacement that comes about. Let's look at the subprime mortgage industry. How did we get here? You know, owning a home, that's an American dream. I went back and did some research. It was back in 1920, they did all these surveys, and they said that a homeowner makes a better American, all right, because he or she will take care of the community, right, by taking care of his home, and then on and on and on. And they also determined that a homeowner will be a better fighter against communism, okay? So you've got presidents since Woodrow Wilson, right, pushing for homeownership. So homeownership came, and it became a huge industry. If you look at this, the interesting part about the subprime mortgage industry is that homeownership in this country took its biggest increase during the 60s. And then in the last 10 years, it has pretty much stayed stable. So even though an industry that has brought the financial crisis that we're facing right now, it really didn't increase, you know, on an average, homeownership. Spain has 85% homeownership in the world, right? The U.S. at its height was at 69%. So we still didn't get there. You know, we got Ireland that's ahead of us, 77%. You know, we got Norway that's at 77%. And yet the U.S. at its peak was at 69%. And yet the crisis that was sort of incubated in this country has taken over the world. This is just my attempt at humor. The American dream became a global nightmare. And I'm going to take you through 4 years here. And this is really the subprime mortgage introductory straight. How did the regulatory environment bring this about? So 1977, Community Reinvestment Act, okay? And if you want me to go into these, I will. That was basically to incent banks to lend to low and moderate income borrowers. 1980 allowed banks to charge high interest rates and high fees. 1982, variable rates, and balloon payments. 1986, you couldn't deduct interest on consumer debt, but you were allowed to deduct interest on your primary residence and your secondary residence. So that's the regulatory environment, okay? So for 20 years, from the mid-80s to about, I would say, 2001, 2002, things were fine. The industry developed at a steady pace, and you had statistics that were pretty similar to the prime industry. So no major defaults, no major hiccups. The industry developed. It developed, and you had rates that were a little higher than the prime industry, but there was no crisis. There was no crisis. And then something happened after 2001 terrorist attacks. We were at a height of consumer consumption in this country, right, which led to massive capital inflows. And when we talk about capital inflows, we're not just talking about Asian countries, we're not talking about just the oil-producing countries, but also entities like Yale University, right? They were the first to dip into the subprime mortgage. And when people saw their returns, you know, all these institutional investors followed them, okay? Capital inflows, low interest rates, housing bubble, and the circle keeps going, and it keeps going, right? At this point in time, in 2006, just to give you an idea of how bad things got, consumer debt, this is household debt, stood at $700 billion in 1974. By this time, it was at $15 trillion, which is like 130% of the U.S. GDP. Okay? And without going into the details of what happened in the bankruptcies and the stories that you've heard about, $8 trillion in wealth was lost as a result of what happened after 2005, 2006. That's when the housing bubble burst. You had many companies that went out of business, right? Lehman Brothers and on and on and on. You got massive intervention by the government, and you've seen what has happened so far. And I take you through this because I want to do the same with microfinance. And you all wonder why would the two even intersect. And it's interesting. Keep in mind that subprime mortgage industry came about because there was a need. There was a need for a group of borrowers. The need was not being met, right? So we were like, okay, we'll go below FICO score of 650, and we will extend credit to them. We're bringing more people into the system. It's good for the economy, and it's good for the world. That was the whole idea. Now, microfinance started with supposedly $27 and with 42 families in Bangladesh and at the same time in Brazil. Muhammad Yunus is considered to be the father of this industry. He used $27 of his own money to pay off the amount that 42 families owed to the loan sharks in this little village in Bangladesh. And therefore, the industry gets started. All right, 1974. So from 1974 to 2001, 2002, right? Again, the industry is growing at a steady pace. And the repayment rate, 95%, right? No collateral, but the repayment rate is 95%. And people are just astounded by what has happened. An industry that comes about on the backs of poor people, the very people we had written off, and has achieved a repayment rate of 95%. Okay? Here's the growth stage. And this is what's happening. If you look at since 2002, 2003, this is even before Muhammad Yunus was recognized, you have about $11.6 billion in funds committed to the industry. Now, what is that? 63% is debt. Right? So these are institutions that are lending to companies in the microfinance space as debt versus equity, right? 47% of that is through investors, and 53% through donors. But look at that, $11.6 billion, a huge number for this industry, right? Let me see if I can. The industry gets to $25 billion. And this is I put some logos there just to give you an idea of how some of the larger global players got into this industry. Citibank, right? Deutsche Bank, Chase, TIA Cref, and there's a long list of companies that got into this because they saw an opportunity. They looked at that 20-year repayment rate of 95%, and they were like, we have an opportunity to make this thing bigger. This, keep in mind that microfinance or microcredit, it's difficult to put your arms around how many borrowers, right, are really using this system. And these are three different studies. And these are three different dates. You know, and this is the latest that I could get. So how many are borrowers, right? How many borrowers are in this? So it goes anywhere from 190 million to 152 million, right? 133 million. It's a pretty big number, right? These are big numbers. But how many can borrow, right? The World Bank estimates that there are about 3.5 to 4 billion people. They live on less than $2 a day. So they have two different definitions. They have marginally poor and extremely poor. And that's how they define it. And they're saying there are about 3.5 to 4 billion people living on less than $2 a day. So if I go here, and let's just assume that 190 million borrowers, right, there are about 3.5 to 4 billion that are really ready to borrow. So can we say we're even close to maturity or decline in this industry? Nowhere close to it. Nowhere close to it. I mean, $25 billion, their estimates that we need about $250 billion just to get to maybe 20% of the world poor, of the world's poor. One of the things that people always wonder about is why is repayment so high in this industry? And I've just tried to, you know, list some reasons. There is group lending, right? You would lend to a group. In other words, one member of the group is effectively guaranteeing performance of the other member of the group. So there's group lending, there's peer monitoring, right? These different groups, are they monitoring each other? You know, There's frequent repayment, weekly collections. I mean, they collect on a weekly basis. Progressive lending and dynamic lending is just if you buy, I'm sorry, not if you buy, if you borrow $20 and you pay it off, you qualify for $25. All right? So you build your credit history and you qualify for that. Social standing, I mean, it's one of those things you can't put your finger on, but social standing is very important because you are part of a group. Let's just suppose it's group lending. You're part of a group, and the only thing that the poor have to lose, I think, is their standing, is their honor. If they default, that's in jeopardy. That's a huge, huge incentive for why their repayment rate is so high. So I want to go back to the subprime mortgage crisis that we just went through, we're going through right now. Here are some of the lessons I think we've learned. You know, the industry came about because there was a need to lend to people who were outside the system. But they forgot. They forgot the basics. They got further and further away, and you had massive capital inflows. You had different tranches being created by investment bankers. You had S&P and Moody's rating them AAA. God knows how they were rating them AAA. And pretty soon, everybody forgot who the borrower was because the banks were transferring to the next and you don't know who the borrower was. So I think they forgot the basics. And that sort of dovetails into, you know, stay close to your clients. You know, if you were established to take care of the community, why would you go away from the community? And why would you as a bank underwrite a loan and transfer the risk to somebody else? Okay. Avoid predatory lending. There was a lot of stories about how these borrowers were being charged ridiculous rates. Right? Nobody was explaining to them what an adjustable rate mortgage is. And a 3% rate, teaser rate, could go to, I don't know, 8%, 10%, 15%. And the last item was transparency. Nobody knew where the money was coming from, who the funders were, who the borrowers were. It was all a big maze. So these are the four lessons I think we learned, you know, from the subprime mortgage crisis. What are the similarities? The first one, expansion of financial services to bring in more people into the fold, right? The other similarity is existence of high interest rates, right? There are high interest rates in the microfinance field, and there were high interest rates in subprime mortgage. Capital inflows, you know, I showed you how you had all these different universities and different countries. They were moving funds into the subprime mortgage industry. Here, you have the same thing. Not on the same scale by any means, right? We think the industry is at $25 billion, and we think that the investors have committed $11.5 billion since 2002. So nowhere near the scale, right? The mortgage industry in this country is $12 trillion, right? At its height, subprime mortgage represented about 10% of that industry, so $1.2, $1.3 trillion. Trillion. We're nowhere near that. But again, if you put aside the number, and if you look at it from a conceptual standpoint, you've got some of these things going on. And the last one is what worries a lot of people, increased reliance on technology, where for these MFIs, these microfinance institutions, to make more and more loans, instead of knowing these borrowers, they're relying upon these models that help them make these decisions. Right? Again, they don't know who the borrowers are. What are the differences? And this is, you know, not an exhaustive list, but the first one is that a mortgage is tied to a value, right? And it's tied to your credit history. Value meaning the home you're buying and your credit history. So it's collateral. In microfinance, these are short-term loans, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months. And character plays a huge role, right? We always say it's really character, not collateral. This slide is really intended to show what some of the challenges the industry is facing right now. Liquidity, and by that I mean access to capital. Just like any other industry, you know, capital is scarce these days. There was some concern about how larger MFIs were getting most attention. So what about the second-tier MFIs and the third-tier MFIs? You know, how would they get funding? Exchange rate, most of these loans are made, you know, for example, microcredit enterprises, we make our loans in dollars and we get money back in dollars. But we're also working on a foreign exchange provision. But a lot of these loans are made in dollars, right? So if the exchange rate fluctuates widely, all of a sudden they owe us more than they borrow, at least in their currency. Transparency is a huge issue. You know, what are the rates? What are they charging? How are they enforcing their collection policies? You know, what do they do to restructure a loan, and how do they go about doing that? Nobody knows. Okay, and the other one is inflation, right? As inflation goes up in these countries, the repayment source is in jeopardy there. So the next question is, you know, what can we do? And these are some of the things that we've come up with, you know, best practices. Let's get together and talk about what we can do as an industry, all right? Let's, instead of relying on borrowing from commercial institutions, let's rely on deposits. So there has been talk that if you rely on deposits as a funding source, it's a lot more secure, right? Stay close to your customer. Don't start lending to villages that are 4,000 miles away. Now, that's an example. They're not doing that, but that's, you know, stay close to home. Financial discipline. You know, there has to be a better management of the balance sheet at these microfinance institutions so they can understand where the funds are coming from, how they're going, you know, how foreign exchange is having an impact, you know, how interest rate movements have an impact. And so, you know, you need to have all of those. What has been done? For Quantico, I think it's in Indonesia, there was a declaration back in April of last year. And it brought together 25 largest MFIs. And this is what they all agreed to do. They agreed not to use abusive collection methods. Okay? They agreed to have transparent pricing. They agreed to avoid reckless lending. And they agreed to restructure their loans in an open, transparent way. So everybody knows what it takes to restructure a loan. Again, 25 of the largest leaders. I think the goal is to have 50% of all MFIs into this fold by 2011. That's the goal. Now, again, these are all attempts to regulate, self-regulate. Here's what we think we can count on. You know, taking into account what's going on globally right now, the credit crunch, I think that, you know, microfinance is a relatively stable business. There's 30 years of history, 95% average repayment rate. And we think that the credit crunch is actually good in a way. It will force MFIs to, you know, back to basics. I think this works. Borrower protection, transparency and governance, all the things that we talked about earlier in one of the slides. So this will give them time to put their house in order. Growth is not the only thing they're going to be concerned about. They're going to be concerned about these things, but guess what? If they do this, more investors are going to be interested in coming into this this industry. So in summary, these are some of the things, you know, I want to mention. The two are same, right? If you look at the intent, subprime mortgage and microfinance came about because people wanted to help others, those who were outside the fold. So the intent is the same, okay? But because of what's going on in the macro environment, and because the sources of funding are limited for the industry, this is the microfinance industry, I think there is less of a chance for these things, right? There's less of a chance for layered product. In other words, if you have a loan, you have this, and before you know it, you've got all these different products and services, right? And I think this is important, right? Socially driven mission. It will keep the overall returns a little lower and most speculators away. Right? Before the credit crunch, I think we had private equity funds and we had hedge funds entering this market. So there was some concern, right? Not to question their motives, but it was like, well, what do they really want? Is it all socially driven, or do they have something else in mind? And I think what the industry is doing, and granted that we're talking about the top 25 MFIs that have come on board, but I think what the industry is doing is good. They are moving towards self-regulation and moving towards transparency. It will avoid government intervention, which is something that you don't want to do, and it will attract more investors. And as it attracts more investors, the hope is that the second tier and the third tier MFIs are going to get some attention. So I just wanted to thank Tom and the Commonwealth Club. Cecilia Burney, she is the academic undertone for this comparison and this study. She's been very much in the forefront of that. And let's see if this works. Well, thank you for being here.
Let's put our hands together. So I want to remind our audience, we're listening to Sanjay Sinha, who's the Deputy Chief Financial Director for Microcredit Enterprise. Did I say that right? Which operates in the microfinance space. And because we've got a reasonable amount of time for some Q&A, it'd be kind of interesting and I don't know the level of knowledge for our audience, but maybe some microfinance 101 in terms of... I was familiar with the initial microfinance institution, MFI, but maybe you could just, if you would, because I think, as I understand it, for example, MCE, your organization, you provide money to these MFIs, microfinance institutions, which then, in turn, lend to directly to the borrowers. But you spoke also about new second and third tier. So I wondered if you would just maybe spend a few minutes to... look back over these 30 years and see the evolution of from a microfinance 101. Muhammad started off, and then where are we today, though? What's the basic structure of the industry? And especially if you would comment also on some of these big guys coming into the play and how that's sort of affecting the organizational structures.
Sure. I think that, you know, the industry, when it was established, you had MFIs as part of NGOs, right? So they were being run through a larger organization, and the intent was to have a side business, if you will. So a larger NGO, say, was involved with healthcare or was involved with education, and they sort of did this microfinance thing on the side, all right? So that's how the industry got started. And over the years, what has happened is that it's become more self-sustaining. Right, because people realize that if you don't make this thing self-sustaining, it's not going anywhere. If it continues to be a loss leader, right, and if it completely relies upon government support, then it's not going to go anywhere. So over the last 30 years, you've had different business models that have come about, right? And the idea is to have this industry be self-sustaining, right? So one of the first ingredients you need is profitability. Right? So you've got a lot of nonprofits in this space, but a lot of companies that are in it to make a profit, right? But you still have, I think I read somewhere that NGOs still represent 53% of the business, even though they represent only 10% of the assets. So these numbers are still mind-blowing, and the banks represent 10% of volume and 50% of the assets. So the mismatch has to somehow take care of itself, right? But the industry has evolved from a sideshow to a self-sustaining industry. Okay. Now, microcredit enterprises, you know, Jonathan Lewis is here, who founded MCE, and his vision was simple, you know, create a self-sustaining business model, all right, but marshal the private capital that's dormant. And so the idea was to leverage private capital and try to do something about global poverty. So how do you do that? So ingenious idea was to go to these investors, go to these accredited investors. So this is a securities and exchange defined category. You must have $5 million in liquid assets. And you go to foundations and you say, hey, give us a guarantee for $1 million. Now, we're not going to tell you what to do with $1 million. We're not going to tell you to put it with California Bank and Trust. You know, you do whatever you want. We will aggregate these guarantees We will go to a bank and we will secure bank lines. And that's how Jonathan and I got introduced to each other. We were looking at California Bank and Trust to structure a line of credit. And we were like, this is a no-brainer. You got all these guarantees from very, very wealthy individuals and foundations. We can do it. Pricing was an issue, right? One of MCE's mission is to make sure that the MFIs don't charge high interest rates, right? So how do we ensure that? Well, we have to start with not charging high interest rates. Well, if we don't charge high interest rates, then our cost of capital obviously has to be low. So we couldn't agree on pricing, right? But we do have bank lines now. We have $20 million in lines of credit from banks and from foundations. And we take these funds and we lend to the MFIs on the ground. And they, in turn, lend to the borrowers. But keep in mind that these guarantees, they're great. Because suppose we have $1 million loss, right? You as a guarantor would be responsible for one. Right now it's 38. 1/38 of the loss, because we have 38 guarantors. In order to have $1 million loss, hundreds and hundreds of borrowers will have to go belly up, right? Because the average loan size is about $500 to $600. And then we have country limits, we have region limits. We're working very actively to mitigate foreign exchange risks. We are trying to work, I think most of the MFIs we work with, we want to make sure they're involved with other services like education, healthcare. So it's a noble approach, and it's really, really about leveraging dormant capital. And it has worked so far.
So. If I may just follow on a little bit onto that before we get other audience questions. You mentioned that Muhammad Yusuf, there were, what, $27 and 42 families back 30 years ago, and I realize inflation and everything else has come along. And you just mentioned $500 to $600 is the average loan now. So help us understand the flow of dollars and then ultimately that end result of from MCE to these MFIs, and then how does that really work down there to that $500 to $600 and so forth? Could you just elaborate a little bit on that process?
Yeah. I mean, you know, these are remote villages, right? And these are micro businesses for the most part. So Lucy, who's another one of my associates, she's here. She's been to some of these countries, and she has talked to some of these micro business owners. And it could be something as simple as a shawl weaver, right? Or I heard a story somewhere where a guy bought this used typewriter, and he became the village typist, you know, with $100 or $200. So these are micro businesses, and these businesses are not intended to turn them into these rich people. Right. If you look at the cycle of poverty, right, you've got extremely poor. These are people living on less than a dollar a day. So the idea is to get them to the next level. And if you're there, marginally poor, less than $2 a day, the idea is to go one step above that. So it's a very long-term process. And these are small business owners borrowing small amounts. You know, and short-term, these are short-term loans. These are not 30-year mortgages, right? These are not even two-year commitments. These are very short-term loans.
How long, when you say short-term, not two-year, what, a few months or
Six
something?
Months. 6 months, 9 months, 12 months. The loans that we make, MCE makes to the MFIs, they're all for mostly 3 years. So that's kind of how we structure it.
Other questions?
Yeah.
Just to follow up on him, so with these, like, small $500, $600 loans, like, what's the return of investment that you guys are expecting? And then the second question is, you guys are here in the U.S., theoretically. How do you stay close? Like, what kind of infrastructure are you guys using to stay close to people who are, like, in developing countries, third world, blah, blah, blah?
I think in terms of returns, I mean, we borrow, MCE, 5 to 6% on average. We lend at 8 to 10% on average. Or maybe it's, you know, the differential between what we borrow, at what we borrow and what we lend at is about 2 to 3%, which is what we need to take care of our operating expenses, which, again, is very, very low because there are a lot of volunteers working on this. So that's the first thing. What was the...
Stay close.
Oh, stay close, yeah. I mean, there is a clearinghouse, if you will, right, that the MFIs go to. And they get referred to us. That's one way of doing it. right? So one of the things we do is to make sure that they've been in business for 3 years, right? We need to see financial information on them. So it can't be a new entity, right? And I think once you get there, right, to that point where you've been in business for a while, there's this word of mouth, there's this referral sources that we use. I mean, granted, we don't have the resources to visit all these MFIs, but we do, you know, as many as we can, and we've visited a lot of them. But the clearinghouse itself is very, very sophisticated, a lot more than you would think. And just to give you a sense of where we stand, our first loans were made in late 2005, right? So far, our repayment rate is 100%. It's 100%. And I wanted to find out, you know, how the MFIs are doing on the ground. What has this economic situation changed? Well, how has it changed them? And what I heard is that loans over 30 days, instead of being 1.3%, it's about 2.5%. So that gives you a sense of how the economic slowdown, whatever you want to call it, has impacted these really, really poor people. So there is some pressure, but we're not seeing that yet. Not at our level. MCE, 100% repayment rate so far.
Question for you. You talked about the problems and perils of what happened in the U.S. market and the credit market, and the intent being of getting low-income people into homes being what drove. Somewhere that intent was lost and greed took over and counter-incentives drove the market and brokers. People got in the middle to make money. The profit drove the process. How do you ensure in this climate now of growth, now that profit's part of the micro-lending, how do you keep the motives, say, pure or noble, and, you know, with self-monitoring? And then the second question is, how are new MFIs vetted for intent and approach and policies?
Okay. I mean, in terms of how do we make sure that people don't make a lot of money in this business? Yeah, this is my personal opinion, not MCE's. I don't know the answer to that, right? All I can say is that you got a lot of players in this industry. You've got a company in Mexico that went public, and there was massive outcry over that, right? You have a lot of MFIs that are charging high interest rate, right? But what is high interest rate? I don't know, right? The cost of administrating these loans is very, very high. Imagine going to the city center using a bicycle or a horse, right? And doing so every week so you can collect every week. So the cost is high. Now, another thing to keep in mind, these loans are for short term. So when you do the APR, it's higher, right? So there are so many different things that are going on. I don't know what we can do to control, you know, that kind of behavior. All I can say is that the market will take care of itself. And it's a very, I don't mean to sound flippant, but it's like the market will take care of itself in the sense that you will have these MFIs getting a lot of attention from other players in the industry, and there's going to be some pressure to reform. The declaration I was talking about, it came about as a result of what happened in Mexico. You know, that was one of the driving forces behind these major MFIs coming together and saying, okay, we agreed to do this, this, and this. You know, and I think there's always the threat of government intervention. I think in South Africa, I can't think of this other country, but they have already set ceiling, right? So the industry wants to avoid that. It's like, we don't want that, you know, because we don't know what our cost of funding is going to be. The last thing we want is the South African government saying, oh, you can't charge more than 12%. So those are some of the things I think will happen, and it will, but there's no mistake, you know, that there's no, they are charging high rates. Some of them are charging high rates. There's no question about that. But, you know, all I can say is what we're doing, right? We're charging low rates because we don't believe this is an opportunity to make money. This is a socially driven mission. Are we going to make money doing this? Yes, acceptable returns. But not, you know, we're not going to get, you know, ridiculous returns. Now, what is acceptable return? I don't know. What is a ridiculous return? I don't know. Because if you go to a poor person in India, and I don't even know if they care about APR. You know? I don't know what it feels like to not know where my next meal is going to come from or whether or not my child is going to die because I don't have the money to take care of her. So it's such an academic exercise in my mind that I go through whenever I have this question. Are we charging high rates? I don't know. So I think you had a... Did I answer your second question?
No. How are new MFIs vetted for approach policies intent?
By MCE?
Whoever, the industry, MCE?
Well, the industry, again, you know, for example, our policy is not to lend to MFIs unless they've been in business on average 3 years. So that's the vetting process we go through. We're not going to lend to you, right, unless you have some operating history. So I think a lot of the lenders, they have the same policies. So what they might do is they get established by using some other sources of funding. And then as they get to the point where they're bankable, they will come to us or they'll go to companies like us.
Now, my question was similar to her question in terms of you have major players like Citi and Deutsche Bank, and these are profit-maximizing entities, and microfinance is an altruistic, socially driven, so there's a huge conflict of or moral hazard. How's that being dealt with at this point? And going forward, what are going to be the challenges? Because like subprime, like you said, you know, promoting home ownership amongst poor people and low income, this is the same thing. So,
you know, what I can tell you is that, you know, I had conversations with, for example, JP Morgan Chase, with TIA Cref, with Citi, to see how we can establish lines of credit. This is MCE, right? And these groups were within their social service sector. So their mandate is to expand their reach. Right? So they are, within these global organizations, almost a loss leader. Right? So they're not looking for those returns, at least not JP Morgan and TIA Cref and the names that I just mentioned. There's a balancing act by them. So it's almost like they're doing some of this because they have the financial wherewithal to do that. But they're not necessarily going to demand the same returns that they would expect, say, on their commercial portfolio. So that's some of what's going on, right? I think the biggest challenge the industry has is, like any other growth industry, access to capital, right? And how do you attract more players? Well, you've got to become more transparent, right? Because unless, as an investor, I know what's going on, I'm not going to invest. Unless I'm a speculator, right? But they're already gone. The speculators are gone. Now you got people who really want to do something, but how are they going to come to this industry? Well, we have to become more transparent. We have to adopt best practices. You know, we have to do all the things that any industry would do. Because guess what? Since 2006, when Muhammad Yunus got his Nobel Peace Prize, you know, we have a lot of attention. So what are we going to do about it? And hopefully, as these MFIs get together and do things to become more you know, self-regulated, if you will, more transparent, more capital will come in. Well, that's the hope.
Yeah. My question, you mentioned how technology influenced the subprime mortgage meltdown, and I believe you were talking about financial technologies. And it seems like your company's dabbling in the same kind of things with bond issuances and guarantors. And so going to the next step of financial technologies with currency hedges and so on. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
We're not engaging in
I mean, as an industry, I mean, not your. I mean, but
as
to
an industry,
to go into financial technologies, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I've heard that somebody was talking about using cell phones to process these loans. I'm like, cell phones? There are no cell phones in these villages, right? But technology, in the sense that, can you use a program to determine the buffalo risk? There's this MFI in India, right? They want to make sure they're not too much exposed to buffaloes. So they're managing it that way. So if it goes to X, all of a sudden they'll go to donkeys, you know, and then maybe they'll go to cows and, you know, flower shops, from flower shops to rice cookers. So this guy who used to be with one of the investment banking firms, I forget the name, he's using technology to manage his risk from that perspective, right? So that's fine, I think. But the concern will come is if they use this template to evaluate a potential borrower that they've never even met. Because the whole idea is to make sure that they know each other, or at least the group knows the group, you know, all the different members. If it's not a group-based system, that it's a small enough village where you have people who know each other. You know, the social pressure to perform is one of the key ingredients for success in this industry.
Another way that technology is impacting this industry, I think, you can see in firms like Kiva, which is using technology to totally, really cut out the middle. People like yourself who, you know, they go from me to someone who's lending and borrowing in another country. What's your opinion of that model? It's very different.
Kiva is great. I mean, I think any attention that any business model that brings to this industry is great, right? I would have no arguments with Kiva or with any other business model. They're doing something to help someone in Nigeria. You know, why would I have any argument with that? We have no arguments with that, right? Our business model is a business model for a tool to fight poverty. That's all. So that's how we look at it. It's just a business model. It's not the answer to everything. Neither is microfinance answer to poverty reduction. It is a tool that you use to reduce poverty. And all these things then have to fall in place. So Kiva has brought a lot of attention to the industry, and I think we're all better off as a result.
I want to remind our audience we're listening to Sanjay Sinha, who is Deputy Chief Financial Officer of Microcredit Enterprises, working in the microfinance space. And if I may touch on the topic of why not in America? I mean, so this has been going on for 30 years overseas in these abject poverty things. And what is it about our, maybe everything in America, even poverty, is too macro and not enough micro or something? But what's your sense of why this is not, and I'm drawn particularly to this character not collateral thing, and I wonder about that in America, not to disparage my fellow Americans. But anyway, would you comment on that?
You know, I mean, it's first of all, there are organizations out there that are doing it. In other words, they are very much involved with microlending in the United States. Right? Grameen is one. Others don't come to mind right away, but, you know, Lucy, Jonathan, if you... there are a lot of organizations that are doing it. Here's the key difference in my opinion. The numbers are so much bigger in the U.S. What are you going to do in the U.S. with $500? Probably not much, right? So as the numbers get bigger, you know, the risk gets bigger. Okay, that's one. The other thing is, you know, this whole group lending, right? How do you bring this cohesive group, right? When you don't even know your neighbor. I don't know my neighbor. I do, but, you know, it's like chances are you don't know your neighbor, right? And she doesn't know her neighbor. So how do you bring this cohesive group together and bring about this social pressure to perform when we don't know each other, right? So that's one thing. But there are, you know, great, great companies out there that are very much active in the space, and they're, you know, they're making a difference in Appalachia, and they're making a difference in, you know, here in Central Valley. I mean, they're doing it. They're doing it.
So Eunice in his book quoted a repayment rate of about 98%. I heard you say 95%. How do we make sure that repayment rate doesn't continue to decline as we expand microfinance? I mean, said another way, is the rate so high because we've been lending to the best borrowers?
You know, the repayment rate is you know, anywhere from 95 to 98%. That's the if I use MCE model, it's 100%. Right now we're at 100% repayment rate. Okay? Now, how do we make sure? Well, one thing to keep in mind, the GAAP accounting rules don't apply here. Right? At California Bank and Trust, if my loan is delinquent 90 days, there's something I have to do. 120 days, there's something I have to do. 180 days, guess what? I have to charge it off. Hand it over to recovery. And if they recover, fine. Now, these MFIs in a lot of these countries, they don't go by those rules. So you need to keep that in mind as you evaluate these high repayment rates. GAAP accounting rules don't apply. However, that's not to imply that these repayment rates are not accurate. They are accurate. So the idea is not to get the money back. The idea is to help this person do something, right? To open a shop, to do something for herself, to do something for her kids. And if it takes 180 days to get that money back, that's fine. You know, it's fine. Because the mission is different. And how do we maintain that? All the things I talked about, right? You have to stay close. You have to be transparent. You have to make sure you don't rely too much on technology. You have to make sure you've got the funds to support these borrowers. And, you know, there's no reason, if you look at the history of the industry, there's no reason to believe that there is a change that's coming. You know, yes, the economic environment is going to have an impact. There's no question in my mind. But there's going to be a lagging impact, right? But is it going to be anything like the subprime mortgage crisis? No way. Because, again, there is no plan B. The poor have no plan B. If they lose this, that's it. It's not like there's somebody else willing to lend them, or they can go to their neighborhood shop and get a job, or they can do something else to, you know, get some economic meaning to their life. It's a very different situation, and there are different sets of dynamics that's driving this industry. And again, the poor have one thing to lose, and it's their honor and it's their social standing. And I think that plays a huge role, and that's not about to change, not anytime soon.
You mentioned that there's a lot of capacity for growth in the microfinance industry. In the subprime industry, we saw that growth in the form of securitization. How do you see the growth developing over the next couple of years?
You know, Bangladesh was the first country, and I believe it was Citibank, that securitized MFI, you know, loans in the microfinance space. And it was an amazing event. I was reading that story, and I was like, oh, my God, who would have thought, you know, that you could securitize, you know, an asset off the backs of the poor people? But again, that was an anomaly. I mean, you don't have a lot of that going on. But in terms of growth, I think it's going to be where it has been historically, except for one difference, right? Since, I would say, 2005, 2006, there's more interest in the industry. So I see it growing at a rate that is applicable to an industry that's in the growth phase, which is 15 to 20% is what I think is going to achieve. On an average basis, is it going to be in 2009? No, there's no way, right? But there's so much room to grow. Remember, 200 million borrowers are there, right? You still have about 3.5 billion people to go, and the main constraint is capital. So we've got to make ourselves more attractive to investors.
Sanjay, I'm still intrigued with this whole character, not collateral thing, and you've certainly touched on some of the issues, but I'd appreciate you expounding a little more, perhaps, on this. It just seems to be such to the noble side of mankind, if you will, or the noble side of humanity, you know, integrity and character and everything. And, yeah. And somehow that doesn't match up with the greed stuff that we hear so much about here, at least locally. And help me a little more with this noble side of humanity that seems to be making this work.
You know, one of the big surprises for me has been just that, right? How do you even harness integrity and character from a group that has nothing, at least the way we define something, right? How do you do that? But we've done it. They have done it. And I keep going back to what is the alternative? If they don't do this, what is the alternative? And not to say that everyone that's a microfinance borrower is going to be successful, even in a limited way, right? But most manage to do something with it. Given the opportunity, we will all do whatever it takes to make a difference in our lives. And I think they're a testimony to that. They have done it. I mean, that's my biggest surprise, and it's a very reassuring revelation.
And as we look down the road, and you know, we're 30 years now down the road, and we've got further down the road because, as you say, 100 and some million out of
4 billion.
30 times that need the attention. Where's all this going, and what are some of the other And you've certainly touched again on some of these potential obstacles, but what's going to get in the way? What are the things that, where do we really need to be attentive? I mean, you've spoken toward the self-regulation side of things, and so we've got 30 years under our belt. There's 30 times the number that we've served already that really could use this and so forth. But what are the main things going forward that are going to get in the way?
I think a drastic change in the repayment rate, right? All of a sudden, the industry fundamentals change because the repayment rate goes to 60%, right? That is a game changer, right? A massive pull out of capital, right? But that is less because you don't have a lot of investment capital in there or investor capital in there to begin with. That's another thing. I mean, I think anything that brings unwelcome attention to this industry is going to be a huge issue. And one of the things that we were concerned about when all these hedge funds were moving in was just that. Not to say that we have any proof that that's what was happening. But when you have capital, especially private capital moving in, you just have to wonder, what if there's a scandal, right? Are they going to stick around?
I might venture another answer to your question. One of the points that you made that what makes this market work is the high interest rates. In these entrepreneurs are dealing in markets where they have very high margins because there's not a lot of competition. I read a story online the other day about a woman in, I don't know, South America somewhere would borrow $5 a day to make Jell-O and sold it for $13. That's a huge profit margin. Now, if suddenly you've taken those 3.5 billion people and given them all loans, you've got competition that's going to drive those profit margins down, and that's what's going to affect your repayment rates. People won't be able to repay. So in a way, the impoverished conditions really make it possible for you to, because you have to charge high rates. These are small loans. There's a lot of overhead that goes into them. So it kind of, the market kind of works it out. And you think if you needed to lend, say you got this 3.5 billion people who need money, and on average your loans are $500 million, that's about $1.75 trillion. Well, it's not a lot of money, actually. It sounds like it's a lot of money to you and me, but we spend more than that. We spent more than that in Iraq. Foreign aid that you know you give to people to buy dams that aren't needed and bridges that go nowhere, you could fund that. You could give those 3.5 billion people $500, and I think you'd have a real mess. But it's that's just my thought.
I would love to face that day when we have the billions who have been marginalized have an opportunity to climb up the economic ladder. Yeah,
I could just add to that by my own experience of working with a couple groups of, I import products from Central America, by the shawls that you're talking about, the hand-woven products with women who are weavers there and cooperatives. And because of our recession here and in other parts of the world now, of course, that has caused them to have their sales have slowed there in their countries because there are fewer foreign visitors who are a good part of the people that buy their products. You know, their fellow villagers aren't, you know, they're weaving their own clothes. They're not buying things from the weavers. And that's one aspect. And the other aspect is that some of my customers, a couple have gone out of business. Others are not buying placing as large orders. And I'm sure that's extrapolated, in many, many other examples, like that. So it spreads because we now have a global economy.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, that's going to happen, and you have a lagging effect, right? But I also think it depends on where you are. Are you dealing with the marginally poor or the extremely poor? And I think if you're, $1 a day, perhaps less integrated with the global economy, and therefore maybe less of an impact. So it's all unfolding now, and all we can tell you is what we're experiencing in our portfolio and what some of the other MFIs are saying. They're all saying that, It's over 30-day delinquency. You know, it's increased, but it's increased less than 100 basis points, which to me is amazing, because not my own loan portfolio, but the bank's loan portfolio, every week is deteriorating, and we're talking about major dollar, you know, amounts. And so if I'm comparing the two, I'm like, okay, we'll see how this one unfolds.
Sanjay, I'm sure this is a fascinating topic. We could go on for quite some time, and perhaps if you have a few moments and people can stay after and ask you some additional questions. But I wanted to give you just an opportunity as we close out to what couple of thoughts would you like to leave with us regarding this obviously fascinating subject, which so many of us care about and are interested in and all that. But what are some thoughts you'd have us leave with to ponder further, what have you?
I mean, I think it's important. And it applies to just, I don't want this to be a Hallmark moment, but it applies to life in general, right? And this is what I always tell anybody who asks me the question. It's like, find your passion, you know, go after it, and see if you can make a contribution. Now, if it's microfinance, that's great, all right? If it's basket weaving, that's great. If it's gardening, that's great. So the minute you combine your passion with your skill set, is when you are at the point where you can give something back, you know, and that's how this has unfolded for me, and I'm grateful for that, right? So that's what I think I want to leave you with, and the other thing is, you know, there's this outer circle, right? First and foremost, you're responsible for your own life. You want to make sure you're happy. You extend it to the circle, which includes your friends and your family members and your partner. And then there's this outer circle, people you'll never meet, you know, and people you'll never know. Can you make a difference in their lives? And if the answer is yes, then that's great. So that's it.
So can we put our hands together, please, for Sanjay? Sanjay Sinha, who is the Deputy Chief Financial Officer for Microfinance Enterprises. I want to thank you very much for your comments tonight. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.